Okay, so that's coming back then to this image of the Awen. So the earliest image of the Awen is of these three rays that arise out of an invisible point. And this image of the invisible point is exactly the same image you get in the Tree of Life, where Ketha is the single point that is both the crown and the root of the tree. And in the same way that in the Tree of Life, from that point you get Chokmah and Bina arising. You get the two side pillars of the tree arising, and then the middle pillar arising. So it's the same generative structure as the Tree of Life. And this sense of these three vowel sounds of E-R-O really the, you know, in the Kabbalistic terms would be Yud-Heh-Vav. It's the expression of the name. And then the fourth term, really, then, is the appearance. All of this, if you like, what you have here is the essence and the shaping, and then the fourth term is the appearance on earth of the which in the Kabbalah is indicated by the second A, which gives us this relationship then between, and then in a sense that's that central line of the Awen coming down into kind of manifestation. And then around that you have the interplay of the opposites, which are the two inclined lines, which are inclining in different directions, which indicate a difference of intention. So beginnings and endings, black and white, male and female, etc., etc. And the, if you like, the turning around that kind of spindle in time, if you like, is what gives us the whole kind of procession of the day, procession of the year. So that gives us this kind of fourfoldness that arises through the experience of time and space. Now, if we were looking at this in the Kabbalistic terms, we would see that what happens is that the triplicity of Keter, Chokmah, and Bina manifests through the art, which then produces a mirrored triplicity of Gevura, Gedula, and Tiferet, which mirrors itself again in Netzach, Hod, and Yesod, and finally then appears in Malchut. Now, in the Kabbalah, the letters of the divine name, they arise out of the single point of Keter. Yud is Chokmah, first He is Bina. The letter Vav, which arises out of Keter and out of the triplicity of the other three, actually takes into account the remaining six sefirot. So that's the work of the shaping. So it's like in a certain sense, you could say that the ignition point of the Yud is the arising out of the singularity point, is the archetypal father. The archetypal mother is the first He. The Holy Spirit, the Awen, is the letter Vav, whose activity it is to mirror and to multiply in descending levels. So you get the triangle, if you like, the non-dual triangle of the supernal sefirot, are then replaced by the creative triangle of Gebura, Gedula, and Tiferet. And these are the opposites working in union. but still working in unity rather than multiplicity. And that, through the agency really of that letter Vav, the second triangle, which is the triangle of multiplication and formation, which is Netzach and Hod, the multitude of feelings, the multitude of thoughts, the multitude of images appear, and all of which then come into the fourth term of the fourth letter of the divine name, which is the repetition of the letter He. Now that is the place the bards would call firm for firm, as opposed to Anyan. And so the appearance of things, the apparent solidity of things, is underpinned by this by these continual sets of conversations. Now, if we come back a bit to the Tolkien story and the thing about Legolas sitting up all night and singing to the trees. One of the things you will notice if you look at Lord of the Rings is there are continual conversations. This is a world that is maintained by me, created by music and song, maintained by music and song. And this is something the bards would absolutely would agree with, and so would the Kabbalists. So would the Christian Gnostics. In the beginning is the word, which is Erasmus quite rightly reminds us, is in the beginning is the conversation. And the Greek of John's Gospel has a dialogic back and forth kind of movement to it that really tells us this is a creative process, speaking and listening, moving back and forward all the time. In the Kabbalah, the unification of the name is the joining of the letters, together, the unifying of the tree. So instead of being experienced as a disconnected multiplicity, it has become seamlessly one being, one flow. And in a way, in the training of the Kabbalah, behind the Kabbalah of the tree is the Kabbalah of the name, which is a simpler but more profound version of the Kabbalah that contains within it all the detail and the profundity of the Tree of Life, but in a single point and four letters. With very often the fifth letter Shin being inserted in the middle of it as the image of the divinity working within the process of the name. Letter Shin representing the Ruach Elohim, which is the Awen, which is the shaping spirit, the divine breath.
Lovely to make a plan of that, or a sort of map of those things. It would be so useful to have the imagery of that.
What, a map of the Tree of Life with the letters of the name, do you mean, and things? So?
Yes, and also to put what you'd be also bringing this weekend too, the E-R-O, and the essence and the appearance and all the rest of it. Put that together.
I
can't do it because I don't know it well enough at all.
The problem with trying to pick one map out of that is that it would look horrible.
I don't mind.
Right, it would have so much complexity in it. It's more about getting the feeling of it. Right, so the feeling of it is more important than the cognitive knowing, because what we're in a certain sense we're looking at here is this sense of when we become present, when we enter into that stillness, which the bards call Tao, T-A-W. So what happens when we become still? Well, when we're really still, we notice movement. And that's why the image that, you know, the image that the bards have about this deep stillness is that it's not static. There is a movement to it, and the movement may be very subtle, which they sometimes describe as the melting of ice at midnight in winter, which is a beautiful image of really subtle kind of movement.
But can I check something with you? Sorry.
Yeah, go on. No,
it's sort of like sitting in the quietness. There's a sort of movement in the body one can feel. Not gurgling exactly, but there's an energy flow somehow.
That's right.
Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, totally, totally.
Okay.
No, and the more we listen to that, it gets subtler and subtler, and you can feel, in a certain sense that. In a way, that's why that sense of we're using different words for Awen and Tao, they're sort of indivisible. So it's Awen is the active pole and Tao is the still pole, because we're entering into a process that is a process of creation, really. And in a certain sense, it's that process of creation that gets interfered with by that sense of me as object and other as object. When we're directly in connection with that process and myself as the witnessing and participating subject and other in relationship with me as equally subject and equally in relationship with me, we're then working with one flow and one, and it then becomes a call and response. So then we're in that state when Graham Howe talks about the unity of the Druid mindset. He's talking about that simplicity. Or when we see in Tolkien's writings the continual conversation that happened, Legolas singing to the trees, or the elves singing as the moon comes up, so that sense of continual conversations happening in the background all the time. And in a way, it's kind of interesting, really, if you think about Lord of the Rings and you think of the kind of the magic of actual magic of Lord of the Rings is extremely subtle. There aren't spells being cast. There aren't obvious kind of miracles happening. There are powerful things happening, but they happen in a way that's interwoven with the whole substance of the world.
This is really interesting, isn't it? This insistence on treating magic as something in its own bubble, instead of magic as something, profoundly interconnected with the natural world and our lives.
Yeah, exactly. And it's come back to the Kabbalah for a moment. The whole point, really, of the of course there are versions of the Kabbalah that have become very split off from that tradition, that are all about spells and domination and summoning demons and etc. etc. But the actual principle work of Kabbalah is to embody the Tree of Life, to embody the name that is the inner dynamic of the Tree of Life, and then to experience the sensation of face beholds face. And it's that sense of face beholds face is that sense of direct relationship, direct mirroring, direct contact and synergy with whatever is being faced, whatever is being looked at. And in that sense, it's, if you like, that the light of awareness is being shone on whatever is being touched and is being reflected back at. So when the bards do the chant ERO, which is also ORE, they're replicating that call and response, the going out and the return.
So the face-to-face meeting is the same as, sorry, I'm going to do this again.
Yeah, go on.
It's the same as I, me, object with the other's I, me, object. And there's no, it's a to and fro between that you aren't my object, it's just you are separate from me.
Well, it's a clear relationship, right? So there's a sense of that sense of I-ness is crucial, right? So when I falls into me, we lose our connection with our direct sense, and we all of course do that all the time. So that, you know, it's a sort of, so when we're just present for a moment, we're present with a sense of pure I-ness and present beingness. This is where, you know, the Kabbalah, the name of God, the name of God in Ketev is I am that I am. I am, I will be that which I will be. It's got at the root of it the sense of creative being. But when we lose that, we fall into, so I fall into the sense of being Ian as object.
Yes, sir.
And the world similarly becomes objectified with me. We've lost the actual immediate relationship, and then we fall then into a sort of a bubble world that's based upon the experience of history, but is still drawing on those creative energies to air. So it doesn't feel dead. It feels very alive. It feels certainly impossible to get out of when you're caught in it. Because that deep creative energy that's at the heart of our being is bringing that into being. And so we normally need some time and practice and work to drop that sense of meanness, to return to the direct sense of I-ness and my direct experience of the other.
Would you say that it's a bit like the movement is I, me and mine, and then the possessiveness comes in with the mine?
Well, I think the originally the possessiveness comes in with me. Once we lose the I, we start to, so me and mine appear spontaneously coupled together, and really it's me and mine and not mine, right? So it's a little constellation of kind of energies. So there's me and mine includes everything I like as well as everything I have, and not mine is everything that I either don't like or I'm not interested in. And so there's a co-arising in that moment that creates the posture of relationship, the posture of perception, so that we tend to not see or push away from us the things that frighten us, ignore the things that have no apparent value to us, and become vividly interested in the things that we do like and want to keep close to us.
There was the opposite then. It seems, I mean, I can't quite feel this, but the opposite of I falling into me, mine would be I, thou.
Yes, I, thou. I mean, Buber's way of saying I, thou is another way to look at it. So Martin Buber, which is the great, really, truly great Judaic mystic, really, looked at the difference between that objectification and a relationship with things that are I, thou. It's another way of looking at the dynamic that Graham Howe is talking about. Graham was talking about a slightly less personally way. Where he says, "I experience it," where I and it are the I is myself as the witness. It is whatever is being touched. What Buber imparts in his I and thou is the sense of the living quality of everything and the personal relationship of everything. So that's a slightly warmer presentation of the same experience, really.
Sort of is ongoing, that conversation between that conversation thing.
Yeah, it is. So it's an ongoing conversation. So then that continual conversation happens. And in a certain sense, it does take us right back to the beginning of the prologue of the Gospel of John, that where in the beginning is the conversation, and what arises out of the word is light and darkness. And that continual conversation brings everything into being, which kind of culminates in the shape of the human being, who is the mirror of the divine, who is the kind of, therefore, the witnessing presence, who is the sub-creator and the witnesser within creation of the unfolding of creation. You know, there was a man came from God whose name is John, Yochanan. Now what this in Hebrew, the name Yochanan, which then becomes Johannes in Greek and later John, and in Scottish turns into Ian. The original Hebrew has within it the phrase that begins with Yud He Vav, and then the letters are Ket Nun Nun. So it's the first three letters, the creative letters of the divine name, are the first three letters of the human shape, who is seen as the gift of the divine, the gift of the divine to creation, who brings the divine name into creation. Similarly, when Menu Taivweth, son of Taivweth, perceives three rays of the Awen and experiences the Awen in the way that is described, the bard who possesses that secret is also, in a certain sense, is also John, is also Yochanan, who's working with slightly different symbolism but the same essential energy.
With John Crook once saying, "We'll bring up, we're the universe witnessing itself," kind of, in that kind of place.
Yeah, well, indeed, that's the sort of thing, and that's that kind of. And taking that seriously is that we're therefore in a continual conversation with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So it's. But in a sense, the bards would say. It's interesting, really, because of course Buddhism uses a neutral term like the universe.
Yeah.
Which is, and the bards would say it's the spirit, the spirit of the Awen. Similarly, the Kabbalists would say it is the Ruach or Elohim, the shaping and manifesting power of the divine that we're in relationship with.
It's another step, isn't it, to just being neutral, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's just.
Yeah.
So it's a slightly warmer, again, it's a warmer presentation. Yeah. It's a bit like, in a certain sense, it is a bit like the difference between Martin Buber's I Thou and I Experience It. You know, in a sense, Graham Howe was also very influenced by Eastern traditions and Buddhism, and has a slightly cooler kind of tone to his writing somewhere.
Yeah. Buddhism's a bit shy of that aspect of the actual engagement. The witnessing is just watching and not actually participating in and influencing.
No, definitely. I mean, if you think of one of the great conversations with the divine, you find that in the Book of Job. And there's this work by Jung called The Answer to Job, where he really looks at Job's dialogue with the divine and looks at the appearance of Jesus as the Christ as the necessary answer to Job's challenge to the divine. Because there's a sort of sense of the... Jung's understanding of what happens in the dialogue between Job and the divine, which ends really in the divine showing Job the whole, Job seeing the whole structure of creation.
Yeah.
And Job's challenge to the vine is, yes, you see the whole structure of creation from your transcendental viewpoint, from your very engaged but still separate viewpoint. You do not know the what is missing to God, he says, in your experience, is the direct experience of being the suffering human being in the middle of the divine system. Which is then Jung's understanding how the divine then has to become manifest within the singularity of a human being. And anyway, I suppose that's that ultimate conversation really between the divine and the human.
In the red and the white here.
Yeah, we're in the red and the white, we're in the kind of the we're in the infinite pouring itself into the finite. So we're in the sense of Christ as an archetype, as a living human archetype. And the sense really of the divinity not simply being transcendental, but actually entering into the small details of human life, entering into the, and therefore the sanctification of all of life. And in a certain sense, you see, what you see happening, if we follow really, as we're doing, we're taking this place, the process in this course, of looking at how spiritual ideas and practices develop. So we start off in the beginning by looking at the kind of, if you like, that very early shamanistic, we look at the place of the stone circles, the place of the tribes. Which has its extraordinary beauty attached to it in a way, a really kind of profound connection to the universe in a way that is more difficult for us. And we start to look at, as time moves on, really from that very early place to the early Celtic period, where you start to have gods and goddesses and particular shapings. We then see the Romano-Celtic period coming, where there's more civilization, more centralization. And then on the back of that, we see the beginnings of Christianity. And increasingly then we see the rise of Christianity. And in all its different modes and expressions, and then in the 18th century we see the beginnings of the collapse of Christianity as a dominant, it's still very dominant then, but as a dominant force in Western culture. This is the beginning of its death now somewhere. But at the same time, in terms of the esoteric tradition, what you see is a increasing differentiation, an understanding really of the connection between the non-dual and the dual, and the increasing ability to incorporate the other. Now, if we had encountered a tribal shaman way back when, in the kind of Stone Age, there's a very real chance that, you know, if we were from a different tribe, that we would be killed because we would be perceived as the dangerous other. Now that tendency still echoes down the line into human society even today, you know, so the other is the one who is not of our tribe. You know, so we've all got this stuff about asylum seekers. You know, this ridiculousness, madness of a country that has actually done very well out of people coming to it. So we had a commonwealth, for fuck's sake. You know, that actually brought the commonwealth of the whole world into Britain in all kinds of ways, and made it a very diverse and interesting society because of that. But that has become now the fear of the stranger. the fear of the black and the brown man in particular, and their needy dependence, you know. So there's a, so you see that tribal element of consciousness that just continues underneath the surface. Now that is eroded really by the, you know, when we think of then that kind of increasingly, as we move beyond the small tribes, you come to a larger sense, a sense of confederation of tribes. Saxon identity, British identity. So that starts to widen. But nonetheless, of course, the other energies are still working within it. What Christianity brings in is an universality. But it's still a restricted universality, because it's a believe what I believe, or if you don't believe what I believe, and if you don't practice in my church, in our way, then you become the dangerous other, who has to be destroyed. And so, what you see happening at different points, though, is the inner side of traditions, therefore, having to reinterpret themselves in relationship to changing outer events. Now, the outer events, it is a outer thing, becomes more sophisticated in the surface, at least, but actually, it's still fundamentally very tribal. So there's a sort of sense of, if you like, Britishness that a Celt would recognise, except they wouldn't think that anyone English was a Briton. You know, they would unfortunately, those of us who are English would be seen as Saxons and aliens and ought to go home because they're illegal immigrants. So from the Welsh point of view, all of you are English, are illegal immigrants, I'm sorry. Except those of you who might have some Scottish or Irish blood as well, you're all right. The rest of you, bugger off back to Jutland, please. Because that's where you belong. But it's that kind of, you know. There are actually people that think stuff like this as well. It's not today. I mean, not just, you know, it's not just satire in my head. So there's but what we see happening really is then this process of having, when the inner traditions, they have to be continually recapitulated. Now what we see happening in a certain sense is nodal people and groups and people who recreate traditions. And take from within the traditions that have existed before them, they recast them in new form. Forms that are relevant, images that are relevant, that address the particular dilemmas of the times we all find ourselves in. So one of the things that happens really in the... you know, we know very little really about what happens in the times of the actual Druids, but one of the really interesting, and we don't really know how this happens, but one of the things that happens in Britain is a fusion between Roman religion and indigenous Celtic religion, and that results in things like in Bath, the great temple of Sulis Minerva, who the Celtic healing and dark goddess of the underworld, Sulis, is fused with the Roman goddess Minerva, the goddess of wisdom. And you get this kind of creative fusion that happens. And you get the same thing happens a bit further north in Nettleton. You get the temple of the wolfish Apollo the wolf. Further north, you have Cirencester Corinium, where we find statues to the Matres, the three mothers. So you see this creative kind of fusion. that's happening between Welsh tradition, Celtic tradition, rather, there's not really Welsh at that point, Celtic tradition, Roman tradition, creating a kind of a new synthesis or something that can function within the world of the Roman civilization, and is adapted to that and has its own particular flavour that you won't find in other places of the Roman Empire. Similarly, when Christianity starts to emerge, the first forms of Christianity you find is the mono-British Christianity in this land and in Ireland also, where actually in Ireland it's a bit different, if I'm actually thinking about it, because the Roman presence is not strong in Ireland. But certainly in the mainland, it's the Romano-British. So what you find is a kind of Celtic Christianity emerging, which is where we get people like St. Illtyd. And so you start to get here a new form of Christianity that's based upon, that still has the characteristics of the kind of the previous, if you like, pagan and pagan religions, but is now organized around a different form in their understanding of the son of the mother. So one of the great forms that you find within the Romano-British pagan traditions is you have the goddess as central, and you have the servant of the goddess. So when you look at if we think of the great goddess Sulis Minerva, in a certain sense the wolfish Apollo, who is the sun god, is the son of the Dark Mother. There's a figure in Bath that they always talk about, with the pediment of the great temple of Sulis Minerva, is they always call this a gorgon head, but it isn't. There's a head wreathed in oak leaves with flames and snakes and wings coming out of his head, and it's like a form of Hermes and Apollo. That is the servant and the doorkeeper of the mother. You find this reflected later on in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of Britain, where we have the myths of Bladud, who is a form of the Sun King, who again serves the mother. Now, this ancient form of the mother and the son of the mother, as Christianity emerges, becomes Mary and Jesus. And then what we find happening around this kind of this shaping is as we move into the Middle Ages, we find as the church becomes what happens there is the Roman Church rather than the Celtic Church becomes the dominant church in these lands, and the much more individualized, because one of the features of the Celtic Christianity is very individualized. You have little monasteries, you don't have a lot of central organization. And one of the things that increasingly happens is the rise of institutional Roman Christianity, much better organized than the Celtic Christianity, and has much more heft behind it because of that. And so what you start to see happening is a reorganization then of a fight back, really, which happens from through the bardic schools, through the development really of a of an underground Christianity, and in the Welsh, in R. Iestyn Daniel's description of the medieval manuscript, you can see that that's happening also within the monastic cloisters, that there's an underground movement really that is preserving the ancient techniques and methods somewhere. Now, certainly in Wales, that, but not just in Wales, it happened in Ireland, it happened in Scotland, through the tradition of the storytellers and the people who are the holders of folklore. You see that tradition happening as an underground tradition, where things are transmitted in such a way that they can be refound, albeit underneath the radar. So, and then at particular point, nodal points, you see things breaking up. Now, one of the points is the 18th century, and that's when Iolo Morganwg pops up, and not just Iolo, there's a whole host of other people who want to restore the ancient Druid, including William Blake, of course. So William Blake creates his own version of the Druidic Mysteries of Britain. What he would call Albion, so that's a whole other deal, really. And interestingly, when you look at Blake, you find that in a similar way you find it later in Graham Howe, and in the writings about this, you find the same commitment to something that is non-dual. If you look at his songs of innocence and experience, if you look at his book of the marriage of heaven and hell, he's taking us beyond the opposites. So these, in contrast to the outer expression of these faiths, the inner traditions are taking us back into this continual conversation, this movement between duality and non-duality. And then, as we move forward from the 18th century, again this undercurrent keeps on happening. And 19th century, we get the kind of feel like the 19th century occult kind of explosion, in that sense, I suppose you could say, where you get occult lodges appearing, you get the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Before that, you've got things like the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor. We've got Madame Blavatsky bringing wisdom from the East in terms of the Theosophical Society. We've also got religious traditions from Buddhism. Because what happens from in the 18th century on, you get the increasingly mechanistic nature of life, but you also get the breakdown of the strangulation of the church. They can still prosecute people for being mediums, they can't kill them anymore. So what you start to see then is this kind of efflorescence of different kind of traditions coming around, which then in the 20th century kind of comes down into people like Ernest Butler, who then comes into people like me. So there's a whole kind of but in each case the tradition has to be refound, recreated, new conversations generated, because if you went back to the even as far back as just as little back as the 19th century to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, you have these long, involved, complicated Masonic rituals that frankly are appropriate to that age and that time, that very formal Victorian society. But if you look at the way, but that's, if you go back a wee bit into the Kabbalah, into the 16th and 17th centuries, you find some very, very different underground traditions coming out of Judaism. So one of the problems of any underground tradition is that because it is underground, it's confined to small groups. and therefore stuff gets lost and stuff has to be rephoned again. So what happens is manuscripts get rephoned, and these and then these stories are given life again by somebody getting interested in them and breathing new life into them and recreating them. And this is the, you know, this is the sort of when you find this in the book of Ezekiel, where Ezekiel finds the place of dry bones and breathes life into the dry bones so they live again. So again, this capacity that human beings have to rediscover the things that have become lost through the happenstance of history, or through the deliberate sending away of something by those who are in power, then returns through the back door and new life is breathed into it. And then I suppose what we've really looked at in this weekend, really, in particular, last weekend, in a sense, we were looking at this particular recreation using the she pack that David Spangler and Jeremy Berg created, can be very useful for our purposes today as a way of tapping into our imagination, tapping into these deeper energies. And you know, because it's a structure that has, you know, if you like, you've got this idea of the stones and the dancers, and the fluid energies, the formative energies, and the formed energies, and that pack we can play around with in all kinds of ways that helps us to can simply pick a card, or we can use some of the layouts that are in that book to help us work with that dynamic. Now, in this weekend, what we've particularly looked at is the underpinnings, both of the Bardic school, but also touching a bit on some of the some of the underpinnings of the Kabbalah, which is the Kabbalah of the name that is underneath the Kabbalah of the tree. What we've also looked at is the way in which really Tolkien's writings provide us with a myth structure that speaks very precisely to the dilemmas of our time. So when as what happened in the meditation this morning, when in a sense that Tolkien material comes into our house of life, it comes in with a very particular quality. And there's, you know, that really interesting sense, for me at least, of the ring being contained in the spinning rings of the cosmos within the Grail, and then being returned into the art so it dissolves. It's a very beautiful marriage, really, between the Kabbalistic forms and Tolkien's forms. But it all depends upon our capacity just to be present and to trust the flow of things, and to trust our ability to not know, and to allow ourselves to be shaped by that mysterious presence that manifests as we listen to the voice of the soul. My friend David Spangler is always saying, our greatest ally is our own soul. And it's a really important thing to say, because actually that, if you like, there's a, you know, his image really is of a, you know, we have descended into manifestation, we know what we know about ourselves, but we are more than we know. Our own soul is this much greater form, much greater consciousness that comes into manifestation, shapes itself, that is in its own level connected to the divine and connected to all that there is. And so when we're using Ernest's verse about descending into the inner sea or using many other methods, connect to that soul. We're then held safely and firmly and clearly, and we can then trust the flow of energy that happens. When we separate from our own soul and separate from our direct sense of who we are and fall into the separated sense of me and mine and me and not mine and me and that which I want to have, and we spin away from that deeper kind of conversation and that deeper holding. And in a way, that connectedness, that profound connectedness, that sense of unification is crucial, because as in fragmentation, we act partially, and in acting partially, we increase the splits and divisions in ourselves and the splits and divisions within the world. Whereas when we're unified, so this idea in the Kabbalah, it is the work of unification, of discovering the simplicity. So instead of these, you know, 10, 11 elements, depending on what you count to art to be, so as separate items, you discover this is a great mirroring kind of process. And then underneath that, we see the simplicity of the name, just as the bards see the simplicity of the rays which mirror back and forth and call in response. And we see then the unity, the core instantaneous arising of light and earth and one and many. And then in a way, this idea that we get from quantum physics of spooky action happening at a distance becomes maybe more tangible to us, so that our prayers, our thoughts, our intentions are not without effect. So that very profound mirroring relationship between the all and the small, between the universal and the particular. It becomes a part of our ordinary daily awareness. But in order for that to properly happen, we have to slow down, we have to become quieter, we have to listen. We have to become, in a certain sense, the living stone that is the luminous chalice of the Grail, that is the green and burning tree, and that can then be the expression of the mysterious name that is continually being spoken. In the multi-level conversation that maintains the world. But and it's, but of course, this is not an idealized thing. It's not something. It makes it sound simpler than it is in some ways, and in a way, it's part of the importance of Tolkien's writings. I think where the, one of the great and most powerful things that happens in that book, Lord of the Rings, is Frodo's failure. Because in other words, yeah, if you, you, actually he claims, if you've got to take seriously, he claimed the ring. He didn't intend to give the ring up, but it was his mysterious compassion towards Gollum, his kindness towards Gollum, his failure, his desire not to have Gollum killed. That in, that enables the ring to be deconstructed. And the other the ending piece, which you get really in the appendices to Lord of the Rings, not in the actual end, is that Frodo himself remains wounded and cannot find peace in Middle Earth. And Arwen, as a, an act of grace and favour to him, gives to him her place in the elven boats that go off into the Isle of the Blessed, where you can, where like Arthur, like all the other great heroes, he can heal from his wounds. And there is something in the tradition, this is why we have also in the tradition of Arthur, Arthur is wounded but and has to come to go to Avalon in order to heal of his wounds. And in the same way, you find this in the Arthurian tradition also, you have the Arthurian legends end in failure. The destruction of Camelot. They end in the father and the son killing each other. Well, not, Arthur doesn't die, but he kills his own son. And he is mortally wounded and has to be taken to Avalon to heal of his wounds. So these powerful kind of myths really are speaking to us very directly of a creative process that continues. That doesn't have a neat ending, that doesn't have a simple. And actually, curiously enough, if you, when we come back to the earliest version of the Christian story, which is the first version of the Gospel of Mark, after the crucifixion, the Mary and the women go into the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus' body has been placed, and they find the tomb open and empty and a figure in shining linen sitting there. And they find an empty tomb. And the gospel ends with the words, "He is not here." Now later on, as it's the gospel gets rewritten, where we're told where he is, but actually we're in this much more powerful and dramatic place, shocking place, of somewhere. The linen he is wrapped in is there. And there's a strange young figure in shining linen who is not him, says, "He is not here." And so we're brought up into that shocking kind of moment. Where the hell is he then? That's the end. That can't be the end. But it is the end of the earliest gospel. So there we are, that's where we've got to. We've got very long left. Has anybody got a burning question or thought? But let's, otherwise we'll just thank the archangels and return to this in a month's time back in Glastonbury. Okay.